So it's often said that Capital Volume 1 is concerned with the unfoldment of the capital form with many dialectical twists and turns, but not with revolution. Such a picture severs Marx the revolutionist from Marx the social theorist, which is something Joseph Schumpeter already tried to do 75 years ago. In fact, this is the anniversary of a book which is in some ways a magnificent book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. But he says we have Marx the prophet, and then Marx the sociologist. And I guess the Communist Manifesto, at least some parts of it, is more the Marx the prophet, whereas the rigorous sociological analysis. And then, I don't want to name the professor, it's long retired, but at the New School for Social Research in New York, when I was a student, in the philosophy department, there was a seminar offered on Marx by a professor who usually taught Hegel. Now, all the leftists used to come to the Hegel seminar, and he was a little annoyed by some of the stuff we were trying to make it into a social theory. But then he kind of announced, we're having this seminar on Marx, but to all of you, it's not about revolution. If you want that, go to the seminar on the Communist Manifesto. This is going to be a philosophical seminar. So there's a long, and sometimes simply protective, and you know, from McCarthyism type strategy. Of course, different views have been put forward by several schools of Marxist thought to emphasize the political and revolutionary character of it. Probably the most explicit of them was the autonomous school that sees every category in the book as one of class struggle. I came out of a different, the Marxist humanist thing, which came originally from C.L.R. James and Raya Dunayevskaya in the 40s, so that's where I get some of the inspiration, at least, for this paper. So I want to follow some of those lines of arguments that have already been established by James Dunayevskaya, Harry Cleaver, so I want to look at a variety of notions of revolution. I'm going to be looking a little bit at the French edition of Capital because some things are a little more explicit there. For those who don't know, I mean, I don't want to get into this whole thing, it'll take too long, but the French edition of 1872 to 75, there's still formulations that aren't in any of the English or standard German editions that in many cases appear to be later formulations. So the first one, the obvious place where Marx talks about revolution is in the second to the last chapter, a working class revolution posed at a high level of abstraction. Although it is not discussed that much today, because I haven't seen that much, but the penultimate chapter of Capital, often thought to be its real conclusion, some people think maybe for the censorship he reversed the order of the last two chapters, the historical tendency of capitalist accumulation. It ends with that brief sketch of working class revolution in an industrially developed capitalist society, and he outlines the process of revolution as follows. So there's the, I don't have the whole quote. Along with the constant decrease in the number of capitalist magnates who usurp and monopolize all the advantages of the process of transformation, the mass of misery, oppression, slavery, degradation, and exploitation grows, but with this there also grows the revolt of the working class, a class constantly increasing in numbers and trained, united, and organized by the very mechanism of capitalist production itself. So over time, in this model, which is an explicit concept of revolution, all these developments of first the productive forces and second a united working class that grows inside those productive forces becomes incompatible with their capitalist integument or membrane. And next comes the death knell of capitalist private property. He removes the word private from the French edition, but capitalist private property or private property, where the expropriate, that famous phrase, where the expropriators are expropriated. But what's notable about this discussion is its very high level of abstraction. All this leads to the conclusion that, similar to the fetishism section, this concluding chapter on anti-capitalist revolution is meant neither as a prediction of immediate events, nor even as a concrete description of revolution. Marx presents here a chemically pure class-based revolution against capital that may not have been intended as a description of any specific revolution that might occur. So I don't think it was an empirical prediction or description. So that takes me to my second one. Ireland and the specificity of ethnicity, colonialism, and class. So when capital first appeared in 1867, Ireland was the victim of a particularly capitalist form of colonialism which radically overturned the entire economic system, dispossessing a subsistence farming peasantry in favor of value-creating production. The chapter on sheep farming, and the chapter on accumulation of capital seems to end with the prospect that the British Isles, divided as they are by class and ethnic bitterness, will decline in the face of across the ocean an ascendant U.S. capital. That's how this whole thing with this discussion ends, that you know, Britain has been weakened by this dissension and conflict over Ireland. And the ascendant U.S. capitalism itself strengthened by the Irish forced out by the British that will become a gigantic working class across the ocean. Marx also makes a brief, almost cryptic reference to the Fenians, a peasant-based nationalist movement that Marx strongly supported during this period. In fact, there's even a legend that Engels sheltered these guys who would attack a police van on their way through Manchester and over to New York. But that's apparently just a legend. But they were really sympathetic to and had some connections to this Fenian movement, which did do those kind of spectacular acts, but it was a peasant-based mass revolutionary movement. Marx also theorized in 1870, so 3 years after Volume 1 first published, about the condescending attitude of British workers toward their Irish counterparts who had emigrated to join the lowest levels of the British working classes, which created a division within the class to the benefit of capital. But I don't think Marx, a lot of people quote that part, and certainly very relevant to racial oppression and division today, but I think Marx means it in a double-sided or dialectical way, because he also saw that if we want to call that false consciousness that the British workers had, their attitude toward the Irish, which he said drew them closer to the ruling classes, that it could be turned on its head with revolutionary impulses from the most severely oppressed working people serving as a spark for a wider conflagration that would engulf the workers from the dominant ethnic group as well. So in this 1870 text, known as the Confidential Communication, because it wasn't a public text, but the International, Marx wrote that an agrarian Irish uprising, which was ongoing at the time he's writing, might serve as a lever to open up the prospect for a worker-based revolution in Britain. And Marx is writing this in French, but you know, his first language is German, and of course, one English translation for Aufhebung is a lever. So there could even been some philosophical implication, at least in the way he was thinking about it. So there's this brief implication of the Fenians at the very end of the accumulation chapter, that the Fenian reappears in America as the Irish worker. And there's nothing there directly of revolution, but it's only there about weakening of the British capitalism, and that America is going to be ascendant in the coming decades. But just with that little hint of throwing in that word Fenian, it's a slight hint of what he's writing in his other writings at the same time, which is a theory of revolution that's very complex in terms of the way it looks at race and ethnicity and how and colonialism and anti-colonialism. Okay, so the third one I think is pretty obvious, especially if you read all the prefaces of the book, Race, Class, and Revolution in the United States from Above and Below. Because another type of revolution, which is mentioned in Capital, centers on the Civil War in the United States and its aftermath. In the preface already in 1867, which is 2 years after the end of hostilities in the Civil War, Marx writes, "After the abolition of slavery, a radical transformation in the existing relations of capital and landed property is on the agenda in the United States." But what he's referring to is what we call today in the U.S. historians and radicals call this 40 acres and a mule, because this was a proposal for land grants to all the former slaves by dividing up the landed property of the former slave owners. Now, this radical initiative was blocked by just a few votes 1 year after Marx published those lines. That's the impeachment trial of Andrew Johnson, the reactionary president, followed Lincoln, who vetoed all these attempts at radical reconstruction when they were, I mean, he didn't get veto all, I mean, some of them were passed over his veto. But had Johnson been impeached at that time, which Marx didn't know he wouldn't be, there would have possibly been that radical land reform, we could call it, in the United States. So in a certain sense, we could say that to Marx, the Civil War in the United States was, at least in part, a revolution from above, enacted by the federal government during the war itself and then afterwards in the occupied South, as seen as that attempt at radical land reform. But it was not only that. The revolutionary process also involved extensive participation from below by the African American masses, both free and slave, and before, during, and after the war, because there was the uprising. You know, it's called John Brown's uprising, but half the people involved in it were black, and it was an attempt to touch off a wider slave insurrection in what was then the state of Virginia, now West Virginia, which broke off because they didn't want to go along with the Confederacy. So in Capital, the most dramatic sentence concerning race, class, and the labor movement in the United States is this one, written just after the U.S. Civil War. This is right in the Working Day chapter. In the United States of America, every independent workers' movement was paralyzed as long as slavery disfigured a part of the republic. Labor in a white skin cannot emancipate itself where it is branded in a black skin. And Marx went on to mention that a national labor union was formed for the first time in the United States in the aftermath of the war in 1866, that it called for the eight-hour day, was already calling for the eight-hour day, and in this, I don't know of any other U.S., you know, national mainstream trade union federation that said we have to end, quote, capitalistic slavery, unquote. Now that we've ended chattel slavery, we have to end capitalistic slavery. You certainly don't hear that kind of language last in my lifetime from the labor or bureaucracy. But what makes it a revolution in Marx's eyes, the Civil War, even though the land was not divided, is that the slave property was expropriated without compensation. The British emancipation spends decades compensating the owners. This is like expropriate. So a part of the ruling class is expropriated with the Emancipation Proclamation. It's not merely, for African Americans, in a certain sense, it's only a political emancipation, but in terms of the structure of the social of the dominant classes, it has aspects of a social revolution as well. Okay. Fourthly, communal villages as loci of revolution in Russia and beyond. The chapters on the primitive accumulation of capital, so-called primitive accumulation, depending on which version you're reading, center on the earliest days of capitalism with special attention to the dispossession or expropriation of the British peasantry from the land and to the African slave trade as part of that early accumulation. This forms the base of a new economy based upon slave labor and wage labor, with wage labor driven into the towns to become the proletariat. It is at the end of this trajectory that the now large and powerful working class rises up, as I discussed before, expropriates its expropriators, the capitalist class. The trajectory seems at first sight unilinear, at least in terms of the dispossession of the peasantry, this whole accumulation chapter, because he writes at one point, describing the process, only in England, which we therefore take as our example, has it the classic form. Okay, so that's in our English edition and the German one in the Marx Engels Werke, you have that phrase. And a lot of ink was spilled in Russia over this sentence, and this was the version that was translated into Russia in 1872, because many radical populists, and there's other passages that say something similar, as many radical populists in Russia yearned for a rural communism based on the Mir or traditional village commune, hoping it could be radicalized and modernized without going through the terrific pain of dispossession and uprooting that Marx talked about in the section on primitive accumulation. Now, in the French edition of Capital, which goes to press about 1872, but for that part, much later, because that doesn't finish till 1875, Marx ends it differently. As mentioned earlier, so the process of accumulation of capital, it ends with a revolutionary working class expropriation of capitalist property after those workers have gone through the horrors. But here, and so it could be read as saying that this is a universal kind of prediction for all of the world. But in the French edition, in text completed around 1875, he opens up his dialectical presentation to account for particularity and difference by decisively altering a key sentence from 1867 about British history as the classic form. In the French edition, the sentence reads, so there it is up there, so far it has been carried out in a radical manner only in England, therefore this country will necessarily play the leading role in our sketch, but all the countries of Western Europe, there's no implication of anything beyond that, are going through the same development. As for Russia, so what about Russia and those other areas of the world not yet at the heart of the capitalist mode of production? There was a more open road. There were other possibilities. And this was a far from an obscure passage in Marx's mind. It's not something that was discovered in the 20th or 21st century. Anyone who read his correspondence with Zasulich or the letter written in 1877 to the Russians, in a manner, this is the part he quotes. He quotes that second version of it. So it's right there. In McClellan's edition of Selected Works of Marx and Engels, Marx, you have in one page, you have this thing quoted, because he reproduces the 1877 letter. You go back 100 pages later, he's excerpting Capital, he has the other version. He, of course, doesn't even realize that it's two versions of the same sentence, even though the sentence has been a bone of contention. So the last one is about the state and abolition of the state. This point bears not only on Marx's conception of revolution, but also his visionary theoretical alternative to capitalism. Because as we know, in the fetishism section, toward the end of chapter one, he says, we can finally imagine for a change an association of free human beings, I say human beings mentioned, because you're allowed to do that with German rather than man, working with the means of production held in common. In contrast to capitalism distorting fetishism, social relations are here transparent in their simplicity, and the distorting and obscuring lens of capitalism is not removed until the production process changes, until it's become production by freely associated human beings and stands under their conscious and planned control. That is communism in the positive sense, and the communism of the future. So how do we get there? Well, one way is revolution. And as we've seen above, Marx had a number of conceptualizations of revolution. But one element that I haven't brought up yet is the state and the need to abolish the state. Now, there's no mention of the need to abolish the state explicitly in Volume 1 of Capital, but if you look at the Civil War in France, which is written in between the 67 version and this more final version of 1872-75, look at the language there in the Civil War in France. It wanted to make individual property a truth and so forth, mere instruments of free and associated labor. The commune was already trying to do that. This is common. So now that language is already there in 1867, but it's way in the... there isn't a fetishism section yet. There isn't a chapter one. Chapters 1, 2, and 3 emerge into a single chapter, and then some of that language is in the appendix, so it doesn't stand out in the way it did, like after the communist era. So I've tried to argue that capital can be connected, and obviously it's very implicitly, to five different notions of revolution. A working class uprising, working class uprising, a much more specific notion of revolution with the lever of revolution in Britain being opened up by an agrarian uprising in Ireland. Thirdly, a revolution that's both from above and below, as is happening in the United States, both before, during, and after the Civil War. Fourthly, a revolution out of joint with the main thrust of Capital, Volume 1, beginning in non-capitalist agrarian societies like Russia, because he does say in the 82 preface of the Communist Manifesto that Russia could be the Ausgangspunkt, the starting point of a more global revolution, and finally, a revolution that abolishes the modern state as seen in the Paris Commune. Now, most of these are just hints. Part of my inspiration is that book that Susan Buck Morris did on Hegel and Haiti. She did a whole book on Hegel and the Haitian Revolution and the phenomenology, even though Hegel never mentions the Haitian Revolution. I actually have some mentions, at least by implication, of the stuff I'm talking about, but I admit that this paper is speculative. I admit that freely.
Well, good afternoon. I would like to say, first of all, that I'm very happy to be here another time in the Historical Materialism Conference. So I would like to thank the organizers. And it's kind of a funny situation because, as you will see, many of the authors I'm quoting here are inside this room now. So one of them is Professor Kevin Anderson. So I will jump some quotations that are almost the same. He had taken from Kepka. Oh, Marx is not here. And Gramsci is not here also. I will start with Gramsci. The call for paper of this conference and also the title of this session are both based on The Revolution Against Capital, a brilliant article written by the young Antonio Gramsci and published in the Journal of the Italian Socialist Party in December 1970. The full version of my paper has an introductory discussion on Gramsci's article. But here, I would just like to say that Gramsci was not actually concerned to argue against Marx's work, but instead against the determinist Marxism of the Second International. His main argument in the article is that the explosion of the revolution of the Bolsheviks, as he calls it, in Russia was contrary to the dominant Marxist analysis at the time. According to that analysis, only when capitalist productive forces had progressed to the stage of fully developed industrial capitalism, could conditions emerge for the occurrence of a proletarian revolution to establish socialism. And Gramsci reinforced the importance of the Bolsheviks in their action activism to achieve the collective revolutionary will of the proletariat in Russia. In spite of that, I built my paper from the problem of a presupposed understanding that is both in the title of Gramsci's article and in his tautological argumentation that Marx predicted the predictable, in the sense that logical argumentation present in Capital would necessarily lead to the conclusion that the proletarian revolution could only begin in those countries with more advanced social development, because the possibility of revolution erupting in peripheral countries only arose in the 20th century with the outbreak of war and the political actions like the Bolsheviks ones. In 1917, Gramsci was not familiar with Marx and Engels' correspondence and the studies concerning Russia, the ones Kevin Anderson quoted, from the 7th and 8th, from those writings, we now can be sure that 10 years after the publication of Capital Book 1, its author was emphatic in his assertion that the historical sketch of the genesis of capitalism in Western Europe, presented in the book, was not an historical philosophic theory of a general course, a marché général, imposed by fate upon every people, whatever the historic circumstances in which it finds itself, as he stated in a letter to editorial board of a Russian periodical, I can't say the name, in 1877. Four years later, he repeated that in his famous letter to Vera Zasulich. Anderson also quoted it here. In the following year, in the preface of the second edition of the Communist Manifesto, the one that was here seconds ago. Well, in the introduction to these writings and others of Marx and Engels on Russia, Michael Lovy, is the way we say in English, Michael Lovy states that from 1877 on, they suggest a perspective that is dialectic and polycentric, one that allows for a multiplicity of forms of historical transformation, and above all, the possibility that modern social revolutions might begin in the periphery of capitalist system and not only in the center of some of their early writings had affirmed. Today, I wish to join other authors who understand that when Marx published Capital Book One, he had for some time drawn away from a conception that could be seen as evolutionist or Eurocentric. But before this, let me quote Colin Barker. Barker takes up an argument that was current in the 19th century, one that Marx and Engels also expressed, and which did not define social movement as being an extraordinary political protest or contention, but rather as a general tendency of the struggles at a certain stage of history. Thus, and I'm quoting Colin, the social movement was a summary term for the various forms and manifestations of popular challenge to ongoing capitalist development. It included, but was anything but conterminous with specifically workers' movements. Following Barker, if that heterogeneity is borne in mind when thinking about the conflictive aspect, then the social movement would be marked by contradictory pressures. Only on the basis of an equilibrium of the correlation of forces between the cycles of protest and the cycles of containment, the response to those mobilizations, could we define the potential for social confrontation contained in those processes. Barker opted to define the oscillations as waves of protests. The imagery captures precisely the sense of motion inherent to those forms of collective protest. Now we can return to Marx. Well before his writings on Russia, or even the publication of Capital Book One, Marx perceived the waves of protest and their respective revolutionary potential on an international or even global scale. Lucia Pradella's studies are helping us to understand that when Marx was writing about China and India since the early 1850s, he pointed out that the anti-colonial struggles were factors that aggravated the capitalist crises that were then beginning to appear on an international scale. Viewing imperialist expansion as a mechanism for addressing the crisis, Marx shows in those writings how he perceived not only the possibility of a progressive increase in the wages of the working class and in the wages of the working class in the central countries that arose from colonial exploitation, but also contradictorily, the disruptive potential of the agents of the non-European people. In a passage of one of the articles he wrote on China, which Pradella has retrieved, Marx states, "The next uprising of the people of Europe may depend more probably on what is now passing in the Celestial Empire, the very opposite of Europe, than on any other political cause that now exists." Well, I don't know how to quote Capital now after Anderson. I will skip something, but In the Portuguese language version of Capital, Book 1, the word revolution appears 48 times. In the chapter of machinery and large-scale industry, the term appears many times referring to the Industrial Revolution. In the context of the discussion on the general law of accumulation, where it also appears frequently, it is associated to agrarian revolution or to the technical revolution in the production process. In the chapter on primitive accumulation, there are references in the same sense as the early ones, but finally, reference to the revolution unfolded by the French and British bourgeoisies. And the chapter ends with the quotation Anderson showed in the beginning of his presentation, the one on the expropriators are expropriated, is the final sentence. It was the revolution potentially contained in the social contradictions generated by the accumulation of capital, the negation of the negation, as he put in later in the text. In the preface, however, Marx makes a registration located in the concrete history of his day in which he sustains his confident expectation on a proletarian revolution. It was a registration that made the relation he established between the struggles for freedom of enslaved workers and the struggle for emancipation of proletarian workers, both fundamental parts of the social movement as a whole. And I quote Marx, it's a little bit different of the quotation of Anderson, but it's in the same preface. Just as in the 18th century, Marx says, the American War of Independence sounded the tocsin for the European middle class, so in the 19th century, the American Civil War did the same for the European working class. By far the most important example of Marx's global vision of the social struggles and revolutionary movements of his days, prior to the publication of Capital, are his considerations regarding the Civil War in the United States. The decade that began in 1860 was a key moment for the complete intertwining of the abolitionist movement and the movement of the European workers, especially the English ones. That becomes explicit when the later movement is confronted with the fundamental crossroads the United States came to and which resulted in the Civil War between the states of the North and those of the South. Marx's perspective at the time of publishing Capital, as Professor Anderson showed in his work in the Marx at the Margin, was strongly marked by the Civil War. It was constructed in the midst of that evident convergence of the European workers' movement and the defense of abolition in the Americas. That convergence was not a linear process, and the defense of abolition, it was not a linear process, neither was it free of disputes, but nevertheless, from the middle of the year of 1862 on, there was increasing positioning of the English working class in favor of the forces of the Union in the American Civil War with an open defense of abolition. That position even included the proletariat of the English industrial cities where unemployment in the textile industry, stemming from the transatlantic trade embargo imposed by the Union on cotton from the southern states, was a source of suffering for a considerable portion of the class. Just to give one example, in November 1864, a few days before the election that would give Lincoln a second mandate, the London Weekly Journal, the Beehive, linked to the local trade union movement, was to publish an article entitled Freedom of Slavery. Confident in Lincoln's re-election and supporting it, the article exalted the Lincoln's class origins and his decisive role in putting an end to slavery. I'm quoting the article. The honest Abraham Lincoln, the man who has raised himself by his force of charity and unaided efforts from the position of a day laborer to be the chief magistrate of the great American Republic, will receive at the hands and by the votes of the great majority of his countrymen a new lease of the power he has so well used to crush the peculiar institution which for so many years has disgraced humanity and outraged Christianity. Well, we know that some days later, the Beehive was chosen to be the main voice of the recently founded International Working Men's Association. Marx himself was associated to that initiative, as we know, and the International had a correspondence with Lincoln with a very similar tone, not the idea of Christianity, but a very similar tone. As a correspondent of several years standing from the New York Daily Tribune, Marx had accompanied the events from the very beginning and took a decisive stance in favor of the Union government, pointing out that the conflict stemmed primarily from the issue of slavery. He was not alone among the exiled German socialists of his day, because several of his comrades from the revolutionary phrase in 1848 and 1849 had migrated to North America. Many of them not only defended the North, but joined the Union Army and occupied outstanding posts in the military campaign against the Confederate sedition. Professor Anderson studied the several articles for the United States newspaper and for a German language periodical, Die Presse, published in Vienna, at least since 1861, in which Marx had been addressing the theme of slavery in the United States and its civil war as a central issue for the proletariat class policy on an international scale. As he, Anderson, has shown, from the start, Marx's view was that the North would win the Civil War precisely because it represented a struggle that could only be won with the Union's decision to abolish slavery. Even so, Lincoln resisted that idea in his first mandate. In that direction, he defended the need for the Union not only to openly declare its objective of fighting for the freedom of the enslaved, but that it should also arm battalions of free-born African Americans and freed slaves and conduct the war on along a revolutionary pathway, or the revolution from below, as Kevin told us. Well, I had some quotation on Ireland here. I will jump that also because Kevin used it. The Union's victory in the Civil War guaranteed the freedom of millions of enslaved workers living in the U.S. We know, however, that expectations arose by the more radical abolitionists of an equitable social and political incorporation of the population of African origin to the body of the nation's citizenry was not destined to be completely frustrated after some years. Was too destined to be frustrated after some years. Marx soon perceived how that revolution had been interrupted. Thus, in an analysis restricted to the reality of the United States, the end of slavery was a social revolution that remained unfinished, to use an expression retrieved by Robin Blackburn. Even so, its importance cannot be underrated because the setting free of over 3.5 million enslaved workers and the overcoming of an entire social organization sustained by slave labor are profoundly significant conquests. The posterior ramifications, however, limited those conquests socially, politically, culturally, and economically in such a way that the social subordination of the descendants of those enslaved men and women, workers, was perpetuated for a long time. Nevertheless, if we understand the social movement as a whole, and that includes its transatlantic special dimension and the connection between the struggles of the proletariat and other revolutionary struggles, in the case in question for an end of slavery, then that unfinished revolution had other impacts. In the United States, for example, as Angela Davis shows, the feminist movement came into being in connection with the abolitionism. The end of slavery via the Civil War, with its revolutionary aspect, was also to have an impact on the way the ruling class and the governments of Spanish colonial Cuba and Brazil made every effort to control the process of de-enslavement and avoid going the same way as the United States. In the sense of the movement as a whole, Europe was also impacted, and even though the impacts were not direct and immediate, Marx's prophecy in the preface of the first edition in 1867, whereby the United States Civil War was sounding the alarm for the European proletariat, decidedly made sense. After all, a few years later, the Paris Commune broke out, and that was decidedly the most acute moment of proletarian revolution in the 19th century. Well, to conclude, I will return to Gramsci and his revolution against capital to say that the challenge we face today is not just to acknowledge, as I tried to do here, that the revolution that broke out in Russia 100 years ago did not contradict the fundamental logic of Marx's greatest work. I think even Gramsci would agree with that. Discussing 100 years after the Russian Revolution requires an understanding that the waves of protests have been succeeding one another on a planetary scale. They face renewed difficulties for the socialist message, as Gramsci says, to arouse the collective revolutionary will. That's the challenge for the political intervention of those who take as their own both the legacy of capital and that of the Russian revolutionary process. And I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to begin this talk with an image and a piece of writing. The image comes from one of Daniel Ben Said's most important works, Marx, The Untimely, and the piece of writing comes from a factory worker in China. In the chapter Appreciation of Time, we see that Louise Michel's account of the will to stop the flow of time. During the defense of Paris, her fellow communard Amilcare Cipriani, who was a member of the First International, had shot and shattered the clock face of the Hotel de Ville. This gesture was a repetition of the insurgents of 1830, who themselves had fired on the clocks in order to arrest the flow of time. Now, to move on to the next to the piece of writing, which comes from a factory worker at a Foxconn factory in China, who unfortunately committed suicide upon writing this piece. And he wrote, "Youth stooped at machines die before their time, like the love that young workers bury at the bottom of their hearts. With no time for expression, emotion crumbles into dust. Industry captures their tears before they fall, have a chance to fall. Time flows by." I think both the image and the act and the writing raises a multifaceted problem, the story of my talk today, and that is, what is time in a world that is dominated by dead labour? What is time in a world where workers are exploited and oppressed? And why does the problem of time emerge in Daniel Ben Said's work? And how does he see in Marx, in particularly Capital, but not exclusively, a new writing of history and a new listening to time and a new way of composing it? To answer the last question, we must enter into Ben Said's biographical and political development, short of his theoretical renovation of Marxism, a point that I'll return to later. The recognition of the importance of temporality did not begin with his reading of Marx's major works in the 1980s or with his discovery of Walter Benjamin. Rather, it had deeper roots, following from a political imperative, his very real and practical engagements as a leader of the revolutionary communist youth during the upheavals of May 68, the Revolutionary Communist League, and the Fourth International. The centrality of time to politics was a lesson learnt early in his militant engagements. However, it was not theoretically grounded in a very deep way until the 1980s and 1990s onwards. In his early writings, from his master's thesis in the notion of revolutionary crisis in Lenin to his 1976 book on revolution and power, there are insights into and very interesting theoretical elaborations with regards to temporality, politics, and capital. However, is not yet a well-grounded articulation between a representation of time and politics as a strategic art. It was in the 1980s and the 1990s, however, where we witness an attempt to rediscover the categories that would make it possible to face a major crisis of historical time. The overdetermining element of the situation was a neoliberal defeat, which had comprised of the collapse of emancipatory hope, the narrowing of political horizons, and on a personal level, the horizon of Ben Said's individual life was being constricted as he contracted AIDS, displacing his energies from direct political leadership towards theoretical reflection. Intellectually, the discovery and strategic recourse to Walter Benjamin's thesis on the concept of history was decisive. It put temporality at the very centre of his Marxist thinking, and it opened a new continent of thought, if you wish, frequented by figures like Auguste Blanqui, Charles Péguy, Georges Choël, Bernard Lazare, and Marcel Proust. With the exception of Proust, who's In Search of Lost Time does play a role in the aesthetic side of Ben Said's reading of Capital, these individuals formed part of what was called the Third Left, a subterranean, marginalised, repressed current that was radical and at a distance from the parliamentary and ministerial compromises of the First and Second French Left. Whether the socialists mired in reformist practice or the communists who were mired in Stalinism. Such a continent of thought disturbed the orthodox positivist variants of Marxism in France. It was deemed not scientific enough, not sure enough of the future, and above all, far too daring. This new continent of thought ran parallel to Ben Said's return to Marx, to the risks of dogmatic slumbers, in order to awaken the liberatory possibilities of Marx's thought. So in Ben Said's teaching capacities at Paris 8 in Saint-Denis, with an intensive group of students, he had the opportunity to lecture on Marx. This involved with certain students like Stavros Tombazos, who would subsequently publish The Categories of Time in Capital, moving point by point through Capital, The Grundrisse, and The Theories of Surplus Value. This reading of Marx up close, which ran parallel to the discovery of the Benjaminian continent of thought, was a kind of productive friction, the outcome of which were two key works penned by Ben Said, Marx, The Untimely, or another way of putting it, Marx for Our Times, and The Discordance of Times. The whole project was an attempt to theoretically align a representation of history to a strategic thought rid of determinist residues. Ben Said set to work a fundamental coherence between, on the one hand, radical politics as an art of the conjuncture and the discordance of times, a way of seizing possibilities, a means of tying different forms of class struggle and resistance into a coherent political project. And on the other hand, his interpretation of Capital revolved around an idea that Marx's work simply was a contradictory conceptual organisation of social time, which deconstructed any kind of religious vision of history and consolidated a representation of what he called a rigorously immanent view of history. Marx's conceptualisation of Capital's temporalities made historical development an intelligible field in which strategic intervention can take place. And there is a very simple lesson in this view. Time is a fake healer, as Malcolm Lowry wrote in Under the Volcano, a book Daniel Ben-Said liked very much. Political questions are never solved just because time passes. Now, the outcome of this theoretical move was a triple critique. First, it was a critique of what Daniel Ben-Said called historical reason. Second, it was a critique of sociological reason. And third, it was a critique of scientific reason, of which his work on Capital was an important but subordinate part. But as an interpretation of Marx, it was an attempt to set to work the contradictions in his thought between, for instance, his fascination with the positive sciences and his loyalty to what's called German science, dominated by the figure of Hegel. But as I mentioned earlier, the new way of writing history that Ben-Said sees in Marx, suggested by the Grundrisse and the various editions of Capital, is a conceptual organisation of time as a social relationship. This implies oppression, this implies exploitation, this implies resistance, and this implies the battle of the working day, crisis, and so on. It implies cycles and turnovers, rhythms, and strategic moments, and other historical possibilities that the existing order presents. This was not a singularly original move on Ben-Said's behalf. There was a subterranean tradition, if you wish, of insights into the notion of temporality. And two figures here who come from very different traditions to both each other and Ben-Said, Ernest Mandel, who looked at the question of time, and the Althusserian circle in the 1960s. Much closer to Ben-Said's own tradition was Ernest Mandel, who in his introduction to the Penguin edition of Capital Volume 2 had presented time as appearing as the measure of production, value, as the measure of surplus value. This is labour time. As the nexus connecting production, circulation, the reproduction of commodities, as the medium of the laws of motion of capital, trade cycles, cycles of class struggle, long-term historical cycles, and as the very essence of human beings, leisure time, lifetime, creative time, and the time of social intercourse. And that last point, I think, should be tied to the worker's writing that I opened with, and that is that capitalist society and the way in which it kills and steals time from our lives. But the Althusserian circle, on the other hand, we have Althusser's contribution to reading Capital and Pierre Macherey's Hegel or Spinoza. Obviously, these figures were quite foreign to Ben-Said theoretically and politically. Yet Althusser had argued that the concept of history and social totality had to correspond with a concept of differential temporality that did not fall prey to the ideology of a homogeneous time, by which he meant the Hegelian concept of time. He claimed, "The Hegelian idea of time is borrowed from the most vulgar empiricism, the empiricism of the false obviousness of everyday practice." Althusser claimed that the specific structure of historical time should be understood in its diversity, because history cannot be read as an ideological continuity of linear time. Althusser's concept of totality assigned each level of the social whole its own specific rhythms, peculiar to each mode of production in a differentiated manner. Althusser's criticism of absolute time was perhaps an important critique, but it remains undeveloped and underdeveloped intuition. And then in taking on Althusser's critique of Hegel, Pierre Macherey saw in Spinoza a mode of thought that was similar to Hegel's logic, but free from treating knowledge as beholden to a pre-established norm and teleology. Again, in this work, the charge that Hegel is caught within a linear and homogeneous understanding of time was thought and was accepted. However, Ben-Said's interpretation of Capital was not in strict continuity with either of these interpretations. In his work, there is a collective originality and tightly bound up with Stavros Tombazos' thesis, which was later published, Time in Marx. Ben-Said's reconsideration of Capital went against the grain of the dominant French interpretation of Marx's work. in general and capital in particular. Most wanted to see in Marx a Marx, liberated from his young Hegelian illusions, the so-called epistemological break, an argument that Ben Said never accepted, I think correctly. But Ben Said's work, and here I take the words of Tombazos, discovered in Capital a more Hegelian Marx, the aim being not to deny the essential differences between the works of Marx's youth and his maturity, but to emphasize that Capital's science, was a German science, namely a science that does not oppose quality to quantity, universal to particular, essence to appearance, notion to empirical reality, law to tendency, truth to error, philosophy to economics, the critique of political economy to political economy, and necessity to chance, and logic to history in the usual manner, common sense manner. This is an argument, I think, or clearly, to take the Hegelian dialectic seriously. But does this mean that Daniel Ben Said's rediscovery of Hegel in Capital, and as far as I can reconstruct, it's during the 1980s that he's working seriously on the science of logic and other works of Hegel's? Did this lead him back to an ideological conception of history? Such would be the expected result of the Althusserian argument. This was not, however, what turned out to be the case. Ben Said demonstrated, on the contrary, that there existed in Hegel's thought an early rebellion against the emptiness of physical time, of linear time, and that there indeed existed no closure in his work. Hegel rejected the abstract representation of a linear time. It's as simple as that. Careful readers, Ben Said wrote, will be surprised to discover in The Philosopher of Vienna a critique of historical reason in the making, a contrast between the abstract empty time, and full time, time that is full of struggle. Repudiation of an abstract, one-sidedly quantitative time and conception of progress, rejection of a purely formal generalization of the course of history. This all existed in an incipient manner in Hegel. This argument has a great importance in Ben Said's specific interpretation of Capital, because he puts forward a subversive kind of German science, in which the logic of Capital is the logic of the concept, the Begriff in German. In terms of the more classical Marx readings, Ben Said refers to three principal references which were quite important in the history of Marx interpretation. The first was Henrik Grossmann, the second Karl Korsch, and the third Roman Rozdolsky, each of whom recognised that the specific way in which Marx structured Capital was done so precisely from the viewpoint of knowledge and the logic specific to capitalist society. In Korsch's preface to a new edition of Capital in 1932, though ignorant of the Grundrisse, he saw that Capital constituted a return to Hegel, not from the angle of the philosophy of history, but from the angle of logic. This means that Korsch grasped the essentials of Marx's mode of exposition in Capital, organised from the point of view of its object. And Roman Rozdolsky would subsequently, in the 1960s, give this a full textual defence in his landmark work, The Making of Marx's Capital. For Ben Said, Capital is an application of the Hegelian concept, which appears in the third part of the Science of Logic, which Hegel calls the subjective logic. The claim goes further. The conceptual apparatus of Capital follows the development of this concept, where mechanism is aligned to production, chemism to circulation, and teleology the reproduction of capital as a whole. And he sees in Marx as showing the way in which capitalist society can think itself conceptually. In this sense, Capital, Marx wrote, is an abstraction in actu, a substance, namely value, that has become subject capital. This abstraction in actu has its own specific temporal registers, and schematically, we can say that the three moments of the concept in Ben Said's work and reading of Capital correspond to the specific temporal registers of production, circulation, and reproduction of capital as a whole. In Marx for Our Times, he writes, Capital, Volume 1, is a book of stolen time, and this reveals the incredible secret of surplus value, extorted from the subterranean sites of production, safe from prying eyes. Volume 2, the book of metamorphoses and the circulation of capital, explores the syllogisms of time. In Volume 3, the book of the process of reproduction as a whole, rediscovers the living time of conflicts and crises via competition and the transformation of surplus value into profit. Clearly, in order to understand the world, we need concepts. Without concepts, we face, with bare empiricism, the existing central structures of a world dominated by commodity fetishism, reification, and the oppressions it imposes, both on lives and on thought. And Ben Said's work essentially is a work. In Ben Said's work, conceptual order takes precedence over historical order, which is to say that in order to comprehend and grasp the internal structures of the capitalist mode of production, one needs to begin from the commodity and logically construct the social relationships existing in this present form of society. And Ben Said's conceptual totality, a totality of discordant temporalities as capitalism reproduces them, has as a consequence the outcome that the mechanical time of production, the chemical time of circulation, and the organic time of reproduction are thus coiled and slotted inside one another like circles within circles, determining the enigmatic patterns of historical time, which also happens to be the time of politics. And here, his writings on crisis and politics are very useful. This is a robust theoretical foundation for what he calls a messianic temporality, which rebels against the quantifiable, the despotic, and the mechanical Newtonian time. In order to articulate a concrete representation of capitalist society, its contradictions, with a view always of going beyond it. And I think that we should see this procedure as and the genuine creativity of it, and the will also to change the world. We must see that it's a way of approaching the notion of the concrete totality, as Marx argued, was a concentration of many determinations, a unity of the diverse. And these, perhaps we could see these concepts as articulations of time that ultimately and hopefully lay the basis for an active and ideal side of a material transformation of reality. Such, I think, was also the spirit of Walter Benjamin's thesis on the concept of history, where he wrote that the materialist writing of history, for its part, is based on a constructive principle. Thinking involves not only the movement of thoughts, but also their zero hour. So we're finally arriving then at the broken time of politics and strategy, the alignment of politics to a theoretically sophisticated representation of historical materialism, where initially in the 1980s, politics was understood as a mastery of time. Ben Said's own formula in his lectures on strategy and party and earlier lectures in Amsterdam. We now have an understanding of historical materialism that articulates a new conception of time that is the basis for an interventionist politics. And to conclude, I began with the image of Cipriani shooting the clock at the Hotel de Ville to interrupt the flow of time, the homogeneous and linear temporality of a world ruled by capital and abstract value. The act of arresting the clock was an act of interruption, the essence of revolutionary politics, and I think we should say that Daniel Ben Said carried out a ruthless philosophical critique in the service of this aim. In doing so, he took note of Walter Benjamin's aphorism in the Arcades Project, that being a dialectician means having the wind of world history in one's sails. The sails are the concepts. It is not enough, however, to have sails at one's disposal. What is decisive is knowing the art of setting them. It is from this passage that I think we can more fully grasp the meaning of Marx's new writing of history, Ben Said's understanding of capital and the uses to which he put it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, all three. And we have until 6 o'clock for questions, comments, interventions from the audience. There are lots of you, so depending on how many want to speak, maybe we should try and keep it quite concise. If you like, say your name so the panelists can kind of communicate with you. And is that okay? I'll take a few at a time and then give you all three time to respond. If there are any questions. Perfect, yeah.
I have two questions. I'm Emanuela Conversano from Italy. I have two questions for Kevin Anderson, but of course anyone can answer. So the first is, which is for you the possible connection between the different type of revolution you have underlined, you found in Capital? Because as far as I know, as far as I, from what I grasp from Marx, from my reading, there's a revolution when there's a transformation of the mode of production, so when there's the change in the relationship between the condition of production and the productive forces. So, and so in this sense, are all the struggles, all the riots, revolution, because for example, I remember the texts from the New York Daily Tribune of the 50s, and there the ambiguity of what Marx said is for me due from the fact that, for example, those riots, the riots of the colonies, are maybe not revolution in Marxian sense, because Marx finds them in a way somehow conservative, and Marx is a progressist in a particular sense, of course, because he underlines and he grasps the contradiction of the progress, the inequality of the progress, and in this sense, the Italian Marxists Labriola and Gramsci have for me correctly understood this ambiguity of the sense of progress in Marx. And so this is the first question. And the second is somehow related, because I would like to know which is your opinion about the preface of 1882, because some scholars think that it's not it was not written from Marx, but just from Engels, I think. For example, Shanim in the late Marx wrote that Marx was not satisfied about the preface, and so about the Russian translation of Capital, and so they think that it was not by Marx, and Engels in some letters explain how he cares about this preface, and so they think. And it is related with the first question, because it could change the sense of the revolution, because if the revolution is not that, the link between the Russian revolution and the proletarian revolution is not that narrow as from Engels, maybe something changes.
Any more?
Yeah, I'm a great admirer of Kevin's book, Marx at the Margins, because one of the things that he brings out is how Marx's conception of revolution expands, I think, as he thinks about the world around him. And there's a kind of open and expansive vision of what revolution is. And at one point, several times in Marcello's talk, he used the phrase the social movement as a whole, which I don't know whether you know it, but it is in fact, at least in the translation, it comes from Marx, who uses it precisely in the context of the discussion of the Irish Rebellion,
yes,
where he talks about how the lever must be applied in Ireland, And then he says, I think he said Letters of Engels, I'm not sure, 18, is it 1870? Probably, you may know.
The confidential communication is like January 1870. Those letters to Engels are a little bit before then.
There's a letter in which he says he's changed his mind about the Irish question.
Just before that.
It's just before, I'm not sure exactly, but 1869 perhaps. But, he ends by saying, the lever must be applied in Ireland, and this is really important, quote, for the social movement as a whole. The whole movement. And I think that's a really important thing. But there's something I think that needs to be added to this, which is that Marx is also a realist. And his account, for example, in his letters to Sozulich, and I haven't read them for some years, but the drafts, in the drafts, he discusses not only the possibilities that exist in the Russian Mir, but he also suggests that if they're to be consummated, in a sense, then the revolution has also to happen in Europe, in the rest of Europe, to provide an international foundation for in which the Russian Mir can flower and reveal full potentialities. And the other thing is that this realism applies. There's a not much discussed passage, I think, in the early pages of Volume 3, where he's talking about the Lancashire workers. And generally, the Lancashire workers are held up as for how splendid they were in supporting the American war on slavery in the Civil War. But Marx actually is much more critical, because he quotes what the employers said about the Lancashire workers and how well behaved they were. And Marx says, actually, they behaved rather like sheep. And this is, it's a very odd remark, but it's there as part of his evaluation of the movement as a whole. But actually, we shouldn't go too far in praising the British workers' responses. When they were faced with unemployment as a result of the shortage of cotton and so on, they didn't protest enough in Marx's issue.
We could take, I think, one more question. Yeah.
Just, Peter. A question about just agency. I mean, you quote Walter Benjamin for Wind in the Sail. So the obvious question that raises is about wind in the wings and the angel of history, and whether how you square the temporality question with the agency question, that your ambition, which is, I understand where you began, that there's a certain notion of getting traction through this.
Peter, do you want to add yours?
Sure. Peter Holland Kingston. It's a question for Kevin. It's about your first, so the famous first, you know, the example that you have of expropriation of expropriators. Just as attention, you mentioned there that wasn't an empirical prediction, and I understand what you mean by that, but in a way, that's because it's something more than that, right? It's something that'll happen with the inexorability of a natural process, and it's presented there as a kind of logical inevitability. And I know Marx attenuates that in other ways, but there is that, even in the letters to Sozulich, actually, that Russia could avoid this, you know, hellish path, but once it goes down the track, once the process, once, you know, the logical process of capital gets a grip, even on a place like Russia, then you will also get drawn into this, and it will have then this kind of inexorable dimension to it. And is there a tension between the broadly political categories of revolution and radical reform that you were talking about in numbers 2 through 5, and then this natural logical dimension which recurs also in Marx? And you get it, for example, in Engels' letters from 1848-50, that revolution is not something that people, you know, just cook up. It has the status of a kind of meteorological event. It's like a storm, an earthquake, and it's something that befalls you, like a force of nature, which kind of curiously is not that far from the way even Kant thought about revolution, right? You can't think revolution as a political act or as an exercise of practical reason, but you can think of it as a natural event that happens in a totally different political context, of course. And is there a danger about thinking about revolutions as basically forces of nature?
Okay, I think we'll give the word back to the panel, if you like.
Okay, let me start with the last.
Yeah.
force of nature. I mean, don't forget the human being is part of nature. And we're subjective beings. We're different from, as he sees it anyway, spiders and the bees, that we have conscious
planning,
so forth. But he does use those. I mean, he does talk about modes of production as similar to geological epochs. But I think he's a number of the Hegelian that you would make always a distinction as well. And then you also and Peter, on your other point, yeah. I think it's very interesting to say, okay, the logical, let's move to the logical level, this thing about the expropriators being expropriated, the very mechanism of capitalist production, uniting the working class and the centralization of capital, and so forth. I would just say that it's at a very general level, but if it's going to happen, it's going to have specificities of social divisions among the working classes that have to be overcome, and relationship of the various countries in the world, because to get to that'll take into Emmanuel Conversano's points. Yeah, I mean, there's this little debate over, because in Vera Zulich's letter, you could read those correspondence as saying that Russia could, on its own, achieve socialism on the basis of the village commune. The Maoists, of course, that were still influential at the time that Shanin's book was published, thought that. And it's actually not Shanin so much as Haruki Wada, a Japanese Maoist, Marxist thing with Maoist sympathies, who said, well, I mean, that thing, because that's where Marx says, yes, the Russian commune is starting point for European-wide revolution, if it can unite with the revolutionary proletariat of the West. So I don't know of any actual evidence for that, but Wada made the speculation that that must have been added by Engels. I find that absurd, because, you know, Marx is I find a nice word, but he's a fairly domineering guy sometimes. I just don't see Marx saying, oh yeah, Fred, we'll add that. You know, I don't see it. I mean, whatever was co-authored, it was like Engels' name was put on it. But I mean, you can look at the difference between the confessions, the draft that Engels wrote for the manifesto. Really quickly, yes, there are revolutions in the mode of production, so on and so forth. I should have said I'm thinking about revolution in the subjective sense of human beings resisting and rising up and so forth, and in a positive sense, moving toward a positive communism, or at least greater, what takes things in that direction, something like emancipation. The Taiping Rebellion, I could have maybe included, there is a footnote actually in Capital, but what is the political project of the Taiping? And this odd mixture of what they think of as Christianity and then some Chinese traditional ideas that doesn't have the emancipatory flavor even of something as the Gandhianism, which is certainly not social. Yeah, the social movement as a whole, Marx a realist, and certainly a harsh realist, as was Hegel, I agree with that. Those Lancashire workers, I mean, yes, of course, I mean, the proletariat is revolutionary, or it's nothing, and I don't think they ever got out of the Manchester proletariat what they were hoping for in terms of a revolution, what movement. But I mean, you know, there is, it's very, as Marcello was talking about, it's very idealist and revolutionary, idealist in the positive sense, and revolution for those workers, you know, even if we go unemployed, we'll hold out till the victory of the North in the United States. Well, you know, Lincoln made that speech so they almost laugh at it, because it's, you know, every school kid has to know it by heart. What does it go? That government of, by, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. But that's the way the British liberals and Tories were looking at it at that time. There's this experiment in a republic with fairly wide suffrage. It's obviously a disaster. It's falling apart. Constitutional monarchy. With the House of Lords, it's still some, and all that, well, not to that, but I should shut up, but in other words, with limited suffrage, that I'm sure of, is better. So the workers had a stake in that if this republic lost, the widening of the suffrage would be put off
God knows, forever. So it's not just that it was general solidarity, but that they felt their aims were similar in some ways.
Yeah. I will start from that, but I try to contextualize from where I'm coming to this discussion. I studied the process of working class formation in Rio de Janeiro. And as you know, Brazil was the last country to abolish slavery in Americas in 1888. And also Rio de Janeiro, until the middle of the 19th century, was the biggest slave city in the world, maybe, but in America, certainly. So it's impossible to understand the making of Rio de Janeiro's working class without taking attention to the common experience between enslaved workers and wage workers, or so-called free workers in the city. And one of my interesting finds was that the first school of socialism and labor movement in Rio de Janeiro was really the abolitionist movement. And many of the leadership in the beginning of the 20th century start to act, or to be activists inside the abolitionist movement, many of them with family background of African Brazilian families, former slaves in their families, and so on. Well, so I started to look for, in this idea for the movement as a whole, the connections between labor movement and abolitionist movement in a more wider perspective. And what I could find was that for almost a century, it was not an easy connection. And that's why the Civil War is a marking point. Because until that, a significant part of labor movement in the UK was not close and sometimes opposite to abolitionist movement. Well, we can discuss that the abolitionist movement had another class pattern here, and the institutional bias, its main way of acting, and so on and so forth. But so for me, it was interesting to see that at that time in the 60s, a convergence could be seen between these movements. And it has an international reflection, because that's the time when the International Working Men Association was trying to talk about, not to organize, but to talk about the Americas, for example, the South America, the North America, they were organizing. But and that was the first time that we can see labor movement in Europe addressing against slavery in Brazil, for example. We can see that in abolitionist conference and some participants of the international, like the French geographer, the anarchist Eliseu Reclus. No? He was one of the critics of slavery in Brazil. And that's why I'm marking this, the importance of this point. But I totally agree with Collins' point that the ideas of Marx, of revolutionary movements or social movements as a whole, was always an idea of connections between different movements and influences. So he uses expressions like starting point. He has this, I think, obsession with the sound, ringing the bell and things like that. So the idea that the revolution can start in Russia but not finish in Russia, that's very clear in the correspondence to Vera Zasulich and to the other Narodniks in Russia. And I would like only to point a final remark. And it's interesting also because in Michael Lewis' introduction of these writings, he did a collection of these writings to Portuguese, translated it to Portuguese.
Which one?
Michael Lewis.
Which one?
The name of the collection in Portuguese and writings on Russia or something like that. But he pointed for an important aspect of the discussion that I think is connected to Gramsci's main concern when he wrote about Russia in 1917. Because the correspondence was not published in Russia. And that's probably because when Zazulishi received the correspondence, she was almost integrating with Plekhanov and the Marxist movement. And they thought this correspondence was not exactly Marxist. So they delayed the idea. So that's, I think, is an interesting point. But I agree completely with you.
Your question. I think, yeah, the subjective moment in Benjamin's work and Ben Said's work is very strong and quite important, and it's a central component. I think in Benjamin, in the Arcades Project, the way I read him is he's dealing with a dialectic or a difficulty, an antinomy, sorry, between the illusions in bourgeois progress, on the one hand, that, you know, the idea that humanity is just, you know, rising up the stairs of history and will reach eternal grace at some point, and the other idea of a hellish kind of repetition of the same, and a decadent repetition of the same that one cannot escape from. And so Benjamin's, I think Benjamin wants to see a way out of that hellish kind of antinomy, and he does so, I think, particularly in his the second half of the 1930s, or the 1930s work, by being influenced by George Lukács, and so History and Class Consciousness, that he reads in 1924, I think, or a bit later when he's at Capri. And so, and then in The Concept of History, he claims that the subject of historical knowledge is the struggling class itself. And then throughout the 1930s, Benjamin, you know, he's an opponent of the Popular Front policies, unlike Ernest Bloch. He supports, you know, the Spanish Civil War. He, I think he has a notion what he wants to see intervention take place to, you know, arrest the a world that's spiraling out of control into fascism and crisis and war. And then in the piece in The Concept of History, I mean, you have a critique of the bureaucratization of the labor movement, and you can see this writer who's furious with, I think Benjamin's furious with the kind of institutions of the labor movement that have held the struggle back and allowed fascism to get a grip in Germany, ultimately of which he become, you know, a victim of. I think that is also, I mean, one last one tied to the way in which Benjamin he discusses the notion of catastrophe. And so catastrophe for Benjamin is the missed opportunity. And so to speak of a missed opportunity is to speak of the possibility of intervention, political intervention and subjective agency.
Just that there is a part of what he does in the second, in the thesis, but that is a critique of progress, right? That and so that's what I thought the problem was. In that it doesn't fit with what you said so far. That it is the idea of catastrophe and the possibility of evading it through more attentive, etc., doesn't add up to helping us understand that in retrospect, what looked like progress at one point, with the angle of history being blown back, inevitably collapses. There's something more. There's something less optimistic, perhaps, in the valency he gives to progress. that something more than just bureaucratic centralism, trade unions.
Yeah, I think Benjamin simply wants to see an interruption in a world going off its rails. And the idea to believe in progress, as you know, the Social Democratic Party said, we will win power. We will, over time, you know, build our organisation. We will, over time, reach the goal and the you know, the heaven that is the liberated world of socialism. This idea was utterly was smashed essentially. And in order to get around that, you need a, I think, idea of a politics that can interrupt.
Okay, I think we have time for one more round with maybe slightly more concise questions and more concise answers in order to, because we need a bit of a break. So we have one, two, yeah, and then let's see.
Okay, that Ben-Said concept of temporality, it seems that Ben-Said's concept of temporality, in this concept, there is a synthesis between you know, the internal structure of the movement of history, you know, sort of unilinear, and the possibility of revolutionary rupture or interruption. So it seems to me that, you know, in a curious way, these two maybe, you know, divergent moments sort of go, you know, they come together. You know, you get a synthesis of in the overall. Overall conception of a strategic time. I don't know, I was wondering if you agree with this.
Yeah, you want her to rephrase?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You get, you know, like this movement of, you know, the internal movement of history or inner movement of history in a sort of a progressive way. And at the same time, and at some moments, you get that ruptural conception of temporality. So the overall picture is a synthesis of both. I mean, I don't know, it's hard for me now to come up with like concrete examples from his, you know, conception of different times of capital, of time of production, time of accumulation, you know, the distinctions that he makes. But I see both these moments in his conception of temporality. So that's basically
the question.
My question's related, it's also for Darren, who I'd like to thank for a really a lovely presentation. The image of time as a bad infinity or time as an eternal return, and then the counterposition between that and time as a messianic arrival or a catastrophe, that's really evocative for me. I wonder, and it strikes me that sort of, it reminds me actually of the little aphorism that Hegel cites in the Philosophy of Right. You know, Hick wrote a six of them. Here is Rhodes Junkie. So the time to act effectively is now. And I wonder then what Ben-Said might have argued. What mediation can exist between those two temporalities in the present? And especially a present like ours, where the capacity for a working class intervention into politics is so sadly diminished.
Any more questions?
Yeah, so for that one, I guess I'm kind of posing it in response to this really looming stopped clock, which kind of like this. But like, I said it for the dialectician and the really kind of powerful poem from the Factory Worker you posed at the beginning. To make it a bit about the talk about what was happening in Ireland and America and what it constituted, I just thought to us what you thought might be what would constitute a revolutionary revolt against time. So you talk about this idea of like this symbolism of stopping the clock, and I don't know, I guess the theme that I drew from the paper was this idea of this abstract time, this full-time dichotomy, and how you might, yeah, begin to think about what could be a revolutionary revolt against time.
Any other... I think, if I may, I might add a little question for Kevin and for Marcello. which kind of has to do with the way that you seem to, I guess the first question was also about this, like the question of what happens to the concept of revolution if you either kind of pluralize it in terms of space, in terms of time, in terms of kind of different forms of struggle. So it seems to be that there's a certain kind of, like, you're making the revolutionary struggle kind of, it becomes a kind of permanent concept, as maybe opposed to the eventual kind of rupture. So that might be the one thing. But on the other hand, I was kind of wondering what the relationship then is between precisely revolution and emancipation. Is, you know, are we, like, is there a sense in which the struggles that you're describing are always already revolutionary in these senses, or are there a kind of distinctions inside the concept of revolution that you would introduce? And maybe the link to that, I was wondering, is there a lesson to be, and I think there is a lesson to be learned, and I'm quite excited about that, for how we conceive the antagonism of capitalism more generally, so on a more abstract level. Would you, you know, and maybe that's pushing you too much, and I accept if you don't want to go there, but is there a lesson for the relationship of class, race, and Marcello, you introduced in the end kind of Angela Davis and the question of kind of feminist struggles in the 60s, 70s, precisely kind of black feminist struggles. So what is there, yeah, can we generalize, I guess, from the historical processes you've been describing and struggles you've been describing?
Who's supposed to go first?
I don't mind. We can reverse. Darren, would you like to start?
Yeah.
Why not? You have a lot of, yeah, a lot to answer.
I think the point's correct. Like, I mean, it's very...
Sorry, it was very general question,
no,
I mean, but it was hard for me to talk about because he has written a lot about science.
Yeah, I think the difficulty is in the subject matter. It's so abstract on one level that to talk of time, we're all talking about many different relationships. But I think history and rupture, it's important because, I mean, if you think about capitalism articulating time, it's a time of production where work is being exploited in, you know, a whole range of industries, workplaces, branches, of industry and so on. Then the circulation, the goods being passed around, you know, all operating along their own temporal axes, and the reproduction of capital as a whole, where you have the process of the tendency to rate of profit to fall, and the way in which that the conflicts that gives rise to, and then crisis. And so you have, obviously, it's a general point, like, stability and crisis. And crisis, I guess, for Ben Sayer, I think, is a time of both difficulties and possibilities. I mean, one of his texts was titled, you know, The Time of Crisis and Chariots, which was what he titled the essay on the theory of crisis in Marx's work. I don't know if that answers the question at all. But Hikrotos Hik Solta and Ben Said's understanding, that's a very difficult question, Daniel, because the way I understand Daniel Ben Said and his importance in terms of thinking about time and politics is that he tries to look at the political present as clearly as possible and to understand what kind of possibilities exist for what is essentially a post-68 and then the downturn conjuncture for the revolutionary left. And so that then imposes for the idea of Hikrotos Hik Solta is to try and theoretically comprehend a present subconsciously in order to take the next step in struggle. And so that means having, you know, a non-sectarian, non-opportunist attitude to the political present where things move, struggles, social movements, workplaces, political possibilities in the electoral realms, then you try and push that forward. But that's a very abstract thing. But I think that is, that's also what the revolutionary left today can do. On the question of rebellion against time, or revolt against time, it's difficult to answer in an individual sense as well, because I think people that have time stolen from them rebel against that at an individual level, I think. This is a condition. This is what people do. But in saying that, Ben Sabre was not a Bergsonian. He didn't think you could just, as an individual, rebel against the quantification of one's time of their life. You need a political project, but then that also means politicising the notions of resistance and movements into struggle. And so the rate... Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much more time I get, but
in limited.
Okay. In the workers' movement, the workers' working class, different sections of it, move into struggle at different times, at different speeds, different intensities. And I think a political project is necessary in order to actualise a rebellion against time, which means then tying all those movements together into a political project. And that, I think, is... That's the political essence of these theoretical questions Ben Said touched on, because I think we should always remember that, and this is, it touches on the Hecrotistic Psalter point. Philosophy for Ben Said was a means of drawing resources to answer the key political questions of the moment.
So, me?
Well, short, we are, so maybe like a minute. To
okay, a minute. Thanks for the question. Well, yes, the idea that I bring here as the movement as a whole is not exactly that the revolution as a whole, but it implies the revolution as a whole. Such idea is connected to a territorial dimension. It's international, but also with what Gramsci calls the subaltern groups, in the sense that the working class is not present in all this international dimension, but other working groups are being submitted to capitalist in its amplified or its expansion, its international expansion. So I think that's one point. Another point is that emancipation is the central issue of Marx's concept of communism. He's talking about the humanity emancipated of its chains. If we want to stress the metaphors connecting, as Marx sometimes do, wage work with, as another form of enslaved work. So emancipation is a central concept for Marx. Revolution against capital has one main social subject, the proletariat, the working class. So that's why I think Marx is always using these images of here in the United States, they are ringing the bell for the revolution in Europe, or in China, in the Celestial Empire, we are facing the battle that is decisive for the working class in Europe, and so on and so forth. So I think from Marx, we can go to a more broad sense of movement as a whole, what in this sense of subaltern groups or subaltern class, we can face the enslaved workers, the women in reproductive labor, and so on and so forth. But it's a window that is open, and it's not exactly the central point for him at that time. That's it, Kevin.
Yeah, just really quickly, I mean, I think empiricism is one of our enemies, but, you know, anti-abstraction also, like what does Hegel say, that the night in which all cows are black, and that's what Marxists and dialectical thought is always accused of, and, you know, a wannabe Marxist, Jean-Paul Sartre, he once wrote that, you know, the black man, as he put it, has to start eventually thinking of himself not as black, but as a proletarian and part of the class to get over this. And then Fanon blasted him for that. This is like an abstract universal. Because any real revolution, even something, a pure quote-unquote class uprising like the Paris Commune, I slipped over to France on Thursday to give a talk, and got a chance to visit the Mairie Fédérée where the communards were shot for the first time. And right there,
there's a tomb that Marx's grandson put up, but there's also General Wroblewski's little tomb, a very modest thing. General Wroblewski was a Polish revolutionary from the 63 uprising, which Marx supported, which was those people became part, and those supporters of that became the core of the First International just as much as the Civil War people support people. And they were the same people in many cases. And so there's a Polish, I don't think he was a working class either, with military experience. He's fighting in the commune, he died there, and one of the more effective, because they needed people with some military experience, which they didn't have. So the actual, I think the point is that description of the revolution in Capital, like almost everything else in Volume 1 of Capital, is posed at a fairly high level of abstraction. The empirical description of the working day and so on, that's not a sociological study in the ordinary. This is just evidence giving indications of these general points he's trying to make. But it's a theory-driven book, it's conceptually driven, or as he calls it in the introduction, the power of abstraction. But these abstractions for Marx, these are concrete totalities, as Darren was talking about in reference to Ben's, but they're not abstract totalities.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, all three speakers. Thank you. We will move to a higher level of abstraction in half an hour. Oh, thank you. That was great. Yeah, really interesting.
Where are you from?
Oh, I'm from Germany, but I'm based here in London. I'm a goldsmith in sociology. Yeah.
And that's the German way to say what in Portuguese we say Sonia?
Ah, no, there is also so Sonia is also a German name. So this is just a bit of a different name, Svenja, because I think it's from Scandinavia, kind of like, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I was saying.
Yeah.
Can I take a look at the book?
Huh?
Can I take a look at the book?
Yes, of course.
I missed your talk, so I'm kind of optimistic.
Did you talk about figures?